The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We're going to continue the Spring 2025 edition, Volume 64, Number 2, Surprising Stories: How Primary Sources Bring History to Life. And the first article today is More Than a Meal: Recipes as Primary Sources. This is by Jillian McKinnon, who is the digitization and description archivist for the State Archives of North Carolina, where she works to expand access to both special collections and state government records. She has a bachelor's degree in history from Western Carolina University, where she first discovered her interest in food and cooking collections, and a master's degree in library science from UNC Chapel Hill. Think of your favorite meal. Do you eat it at a restaurant or at home? Who cooks it? What ingredients does it feature? What do you like most about it? Whether or not there is a physical copy of the ingredients and method, most dishes have a recipe originating from somewhere. Recipes can be in cookbooks, part of online blogs, or even written on scraps of paper. No matter the format, recipes provide key insights into daily life and culture. For example, trends in ingredient use across recipes can tell us about a period's economic or social conditions. Method descriptions often showcase new technologies that make cooking more efficient. Ultimately, using recipes as primary sources provides insight into the individuals who wrote them and the broader cultural, social, and economic contexts in which they existed. A recipe's ingredients provide a wealth of information about a dish's creative context. In North Carolina, for example, cookbooks are often based on regional ingredients. In the Coastal Plain, community cookbooks such as Seafood Cookery from Carteret County Kitchens, 1966, and North Carolina Blue Crab Recipes, 1975, focus solely on seafood recipes, highlighting the importance of fishing in the regional economy. Tar Heel Yam Dishes for Health and Happiness, 1962, held by UNC Chapel Hill, showcases the state's strong agricultural tradition of sweet potato farming. These cookbooks often include multiple variations on one common dish, like sweet potato casserole or fried fish, indicating the popularity of staple dishes across time and region. Often in historical cookbooks, recipe ingredients also emphasize economic and social trends that transcend regionality. For example, recipes written during pivotal eras, such as the Great Depression and World War II, 1939 to 1945, often feature fewer and simpler ingredients, reflecting poor economic conditions and war rationing. Staple items like butter, sugar, coffee, and some meats were excluded from recipes until the war effort waned in the United States. In the late 1940s and 1950s, the rise of commercial ingredients, spearheaded by brands such as Campbell's, Lipton, and Betty Crocker, made cooking more efficient for women who increasingly worked outside the home. Consequently, recipes of this era include more commercial food products such as condensed soups, soup mixes, and boxed cake mixes, while emphasizing their quick and simple nature. Although historical documents often feature famous or well-known participants, cookbooks highlight that anyone can create a recipe, including you. Community cookbooks from religious groups, junior leagues, social clubs, and other organizations can reflect the tastes and social conditions of their contributors. For example, cookbooks such as Favorite Recipes from Macon County Home Demonstration Clubs in 1961, the Wake Forest University Club Cookbook from 1970, and Seaboard to Sideboard 1998 are compilations of locally contributed recipes published by small organizations rather than publishing companies. These cookbooks, frequently themed around a location or ingredient, feature the favorite recipes of everyday citizens and provide insight into local culinary trends. You may even have a community cookbook in your own home. As we analyze historical recipes and community cookbooks, we must remember that all primary sources present a perspective. To that extent, it is important to note that some groups have been frequently and often intentionally excluded from the historical record. In the American South, many culinary traditions can be traced back to enslaved African Americans, but they are rarely, if ever, credited in early cookbooks or manuscript recipes. Well-known Southern foods such as collard greens and pork barbecue can be traced to enslaved communities silenced in the historical record. In the 1900s, many community cookbook recipes were contributed by local women, but their names were excluded, presented instead under their spouse's name. This functionally erased women from the record. Facing these realities, we must dig deeper to uncover the histories of those excluded from prominent primary sources. Next time you read a cookbook or recipe, think of all the people who contributed knowledge to the method or ingredient makeup over time that may not be listed as an author. While we often think of the food that we eat just as that, food, it can be so much more when we view recipes as primary source windows into the past. By analyzing a recipe's ingredients, method, period, or contributor, we can learn valuable information about the social, political, and economic contexts in which they were created. As you use recipes and experience new exciting meals, consider how they could be a useful primary source for future researchers. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs of this article. A handmade recipe for potato salad circa 1880s in the Montford McGehee Papers, Southern Historical Collection, Wilson Special Collections Library, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. A young woman checks on dinner, perhaps a family recipe, circa the 1930s. Strawberry recipes from 1920. And Betty Crocker helped change the way we cooked by introducing boxed cake mixes in the 1940s. Next, activities just for fun. And tying in with the previous article, here's Make Your Own Cookbook by Kathy East. Do you have a favorite recipe? Where did it come from? Did you know that history may be hiding in the food you like to eat? Here's how to create a cookbook using primary sources like oral histories, family recipe cards, old cookbooks, and photographs. Before you begin, check out the article, What is a Primary Source? Get tips on how to conduct oral histories, and read More Than a Meal, Recipes as Primary Sources, which we just read. Step 1. Choose a cookbook theme. Could be family recipes, recipes from neighbors or community members, recipes that reflect the history of your town or school, recipes from your Tar Heel Junior Historian Association's club members or friends. Step 2. Gather primary sources. Interview family members, neighbors, friends, or community members to collect recipes and the stories behind them. Take notes or record the interviews with permission, and look for old recipe cards, cookbooks, or photos at home or in the community. Step 3. Organize and write recipes. for each recipe include the recipe name, list of ingredients in the order they will be used in the recipe, step-by-step instructions, the person who contributed the recipe and their story, any special memories or traditions connected to the recipe. Step 4. Draw pictures of the food or the person who shared the recipe. Ask for family or community photos with permission. Create artwork showing where ingredients come from. Step 5. Compile and design the cookbook. Decide on the order by meal type, contributor, or theme. Neatly write or type up the recipes and stories. Add a title page, table of contents, and an introduction. Get creative. Bind the cookbook using staples, ribbon, report covers, or investigate having it printed. Step 6. Share your cookbook. Share your finished cookbook with classmates, families, or the school library. Be sure to share with contributors. Consider making copies as gifts or as a class fundraiser. Look around to see if your family has old cookbooks or a box of recipe cards. These often hold clues to your family food history. And here are some sample interview questions. Try these sample interview questions. Don't be shy. People are often delighted that you're interested in their recipes or history. What is your favorite recipe? Why is it special to you? Where did you learn to make this dish? Did a family member teach you? Are there any special memories or traditions connected to this recipe? What ingredients do you use and where do you get them? Can you share a story about a time you made this recipe? Also in Activities Just for Fun, Seek and Find Activity by Colleen McGilvery. Study the close-up images of this artifact from the North Carolina Museum of History. Can you find the full image in the magazine? Once you find the full image, read about the artifact and then answer the questions below. What is the artifact from the close-up images? What community does the artifact come from? What type of event would a member of the community attend and wear this artifact? Think about your community. Do you celebrate big holidays or other events? And what do you wear for big holidays or events that you attend? The next article is Archiving Digital History, an interview with Alice Shahan, digital archivist at the State Archives of North Carolina. How has this digital revolution changed how archivists take charge of primary resources? We interviewed Alice Shahan, digital archivist at the State Archives of North Carolina, to find out. An archives is a physical or digital collection of historical records. An archivist is a person who has the job of collecting, storing, and managing important materials in an archive. A digital archivist is an individual responsible for the management and preservation of electronic archival records. Records are historical information or data held in an archive. Repository is a place used to store important items or records of continuing or lasting value. A collection is the holdings of a repository taken as a whole, and preservation, the work of protecting the items in a collection and taking action to prevent deterioration or loss. What is the State Archives of North Carolina? The State Archives of North Carolina is where important records, primary sources, about North Carolina's history are kept safe. It's part of the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. The State Archives takes care of government records from the state, counties, cities, and state universities. It also collects and protects personal documents, photos, and other materials that tell the story of North Carolina. The digital archivist is part of the digital services section, which makes sure that digital records like scans of photos, documents, and more, are saved properly and are easy to access. And here is the interview. Tar Heel Jr. Historian. Can you tell us about the work you do? What is a digital archivist? Shahan. The State Archives of North Carolina and the State Library work together to manage the North Carolina Digital Repository. The digital archivist is in charge of organizing and keeping safe all the records in the North Carolina Digital Repository. I work with other archivists to bring in new digital materials. These records may come from people donating records of historical value to North Carolina, or they may come from local governments or state government offices. When the State Archives digitizes a collection or makes a digital scan of paper records, I help make sure the files are safely stored, preserved, and remain accessible. I also use special software tools to check that the collections in the digital repository remain unchanged in any way. My job is mostly about making sure these digital records are preserved for the future. Tar Heel Jr. Historian. How did you get interested in this as a career? What most excites you about your work? Shahan. I first got into this area of work because I really liked the idea of helping people find answers to their questions. Before joining the State Archives, I worked in the archives of museums, independent schools, financial institutions, a university, and even the archives of a law firm. I found that by working closely with the records of these institutions, I got to learn interesting pieces of history that felt hidden until I was able to organize and preserve them so they were no longer a secret. I'm a curious person, and I liked that no matter what type of collection it was, I learned from it. I would come away with a deeper understanding of the subject, and often I had to figure out a new technical skill to answer a need. I saw each challenge as an adventure, and that's part of how I ultimately transitioned into my current role of digital archivist. Tar Heel Jr. Historian. What is the main difference between how we've archived material in the past and digital archives? Is it the same, just online, or is there more to it? Shahan. There are a lot of similarities. Just like with physical collections, we still organize, describe, and make them easy to access. But preserving a digital record is different from preserving a physical one. Let's say the thing we wanted to preserve is a piece of paper. To keep it safe, we would make sure that the temperature, humidity, and exposure to light are just right so the paper doesn't get damaged. Now let's imagine we want to preserve a digital record. We think about not just the text, but other features and information it contains. We work to preserve evidence that the digital record is what we say it is. Tar Heel Jr. Historian, what are some of the advantages of digital archives? Shahan, a huge advantage is how collections can be more accessible. It is possible for one of our junior historians here in North Carolina to look through digital collections at, say, the British Museum, just with a click or two. That's been the case for a while now, but I still think it's cool. Additionally, digitalization can make it easier for archives to make items available that are very fragile or at high risk for damage. Tar Heel Jr. Historian, what are some of the downsides? What are your concerns? Shahan, we still encounter a misunderstanding of how much upkeep is involved in digital archives. Take digitization of historical records as an example. There's a misconception that once an item is digitized, it's preserved, as in, we've saved it, we're done. Digitization is an important step, but preservation doesn't stop there. For a digitized item to remain accessible, long-term management is required. We have software tools we use regularly to verify that the digital object is unchanged. Tar Heel Jr. Historian. What are the challenges that you face as a digital archivist in saving and organizing digital content? Shahan. The records in the State Archives of North Carolina and the North Carolina Digital Collections are public records that belong to the people. Their preservation is a lot of responsibility. The long-term management I mentioned earlier is key. We work to be prepared to prove that the digital record is what the archive says it is, that it is authentic. Tar Heel Jr. Historian. How can people, especially kids, find and use digital primary sources? Shahan. I would start by speaking with your local librarian about what you want to research using primary sources. Whether it's at school or your public library, the librarians will be able to point you in the right direction. If you're interested in exploring the North Carolina Digital Collections, which are available at digital.ncdcr.gov, contains all sorts of resources, from oral history interviews to digitized photographs on topics related to North Carolina. The digital collections are free to use and full-text searchable, and it brings together content from the State Archives in North Carolina and the State Library of North Carolina. Tar Heel Jr. Historian, how have personal computers, the Internet, and smartphones changed how historians research, collect, and preserve primary sources? Shahan, I typically work with the collections themselves rather than with historians conducting research. We do our best to save the record in the format it was created. The State Archives does archive modern communications like government websites, social media accounts that capture historically significant information, email accounts of elected officials, and even text messages of historical value. Tar Heel Jr. Historian, what do you think about computers and things like social media, Photoshop, ChatGPT, etc., and how they're changing how historians do their work? Can we be sure things are real or true? Shahan, this is a tricky question. I think there's always been a need to think critically about the information we encounter. I'm grateful for how school media specialists and public librarians have historically done an excellent job teaching us how to find good, truthful information. It's a foundational research skill that is even more important today with all the new digital tools. So it's important to ask questions about records you see and hear. Is this real? Who made it? Why did they make it? By thinking critically, we can make sure we understand history more accurately, or even realize that we may not know the answer, and that's okay. Next article is a closer look. Surprising stories from primary resources. Look closely at these three items of clothing with your historian's eye. How are they different? How are they alike? What details might help you learn more? The first one is a Hmong outfit, circa 1998. Hmong is spelled H-M-O-N-G. This artifact is a primary source that tells us about people from Southeast Asia who settled in North Carolina as refugees in the late 1970s and 1980s. They brought their tradition with them, including Hmong New Year, a multi-day harvest celebration that happens in late fall. This beaded outfit is an example of the traditional clothing they might wear. Do you wear special outfits for your family celebrations? Or maybe you've seen old photos of relatives wearing traditional clothing. Ask questions to see what you can learn about your family's history. The second garment is a dress circa 1860 to 1867. Who do you think might have worn this faded pinkish outfit? At first glance, many people assume it was worn by a girl, but museum curators know that this dress was worn by Francis Battle Frank Dancy, born 1860, died 1922, of Tarboro when he was a young boy. Curators know from studying other clothing from the early 1900s that styles for younger children were gender neutral. Babies wore long dresses. Both young boys and young girls wore shorter dresses. Boys would start to wear short pants between the ages of 4 and 7, but girls were only allowed to wear dresses for the rest of their lives. Fun fact, today some people still say blue is for boys and pink is for girls, but boys during this time period often wore pink while girls wore blue. And the third garment is a paper dress circa 1965 to 1975. Would you think that this dress is more modern than the outfit from the 1800s? What clues made you think so? This short dress was part of a trend in novelty clothing made from cellulose and paper. You could buy paper dresses for only a dollar because they were intended to be worn once and then thrown away. Can you believe the museum has one that's 50 years old? By 1967, Mars Manufacturing of Asheville was the nation's top producer of paper clothing. This dress was made by Smart Set Sportswear, also of Asheville. Fun fact, researching the 1960s, you will learn that the miniskirt first became popular around 1966. With paper dresses like this one, consumers could use scissors to trim them as short as they wanted. Here are some other objects from the museum's collection. There's a newspaper pattern from 1909. While packing up some things at the museum, textile conservator Paige Myers found a piece of lace wrapped around some old newspaper. Or that's what she discovered at first. When she looked closely, she discovered she'd found two pieces of a homemade pattern cut for a corset cover. The newspaper pattern had been cut from a copy of the Charlotte Observer dated July 24, 1909. See how even unexpected scraps like these can be primary sources? It's because they tell us something about life in the early 1900s. Poor or thrifty people reused old newspapers for a variety of purposes, including dress patterns, insulation, cleaning, and even for wrapping paper. We can also see advertisements for the Selwyn Hotel and several department stores. An Ivy's ad proclaimed that their fancy shirtwaists and wash skirts were worth at least $1.75, but buyers could buy them for only 98 cents each. Prices have changed, but ads are still much the same. And here's some shoes circa mid-1700s. And a pair from 1861 to 1862. The name Mrs. Wilson Blunt is written on the bottom of the cream-colored shoes. We don't know much about her, but her shoes give us clues. These fancy shoes are made of silk and linen with leather soles. Curators believe, from comparing them to other similar items in museum collections, that she likely had her shoes imported from England. This suggests she was a fashionable woman from a prosperous family who lived in North Carolina in the mid-1700s. Compare those to this big wooden shoe that was worn about 100 years later. It was manufactured on steam-driven machinery at the Wooden Shoe Factory operated by Anthony Fraps and Philip Thiem in Raleigh. Working men sometimes wore wooden shoes because they were waterproof and durable. But this one tells us a story about life in the 1860s. During the Civil War, wooden shoes became a bit more common when impoverished North Carolinians could not find or afford leather shoes. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.